Coming up on KSCP News, how do scientists monitor faraway volcanoes? And what do tribes want from Trump? Stay tuned. Good afternoon. You're listening to KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint. I'm Marissa Williams with some local news on Thursday, February 2nd, 2017. There are monitoring instruments on 31 of the most active volcanoes in Alaska, but there's nothing on the one erupting now. Bogosov Volcano is on a tiny uninhabited island in the middle of the Bering Sea, and for the last 6 weeks, it's been spraying ash up to 35,000 feet in the air. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel reports on how scientists keep tabs on the restless volcano from afar.
Since mid-December, Bogosov has erupted more than two dozen times.
Typically, they've happened sort of late at night. The volcanoes are kind of like babies. They never come at a convenient time.
That's Dave Schneider, a geophysicist at the U.S. Geological Survey in Anchorage. He says unpredictable and frequent eruptions have kept scientists up around the clock doing status checks, but the technology has gotten to the point where the crew can do most monitoring from anywhere, including their homes, and the team can act quickly when the need arises. Last year, Pavlov, one of Alaska's most active volcanoes, had a surprise eruption that caught Schneider at the Easter dinner table.
You know, you kind of move aside the ham and you open up your laptop and you take a look at what's going on. And that's just what we do.
But watching Bogosov is more tricky than Pavlov due to its remoteness and lack of on-island monitoring network. Bogosov belongs to a rare class of submarine volcanoes that have erupted through the ocean surface. There are only a handful around the world, which means researchers at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, or AVO, are looking for clues in the history of a similar Icelandic volcano. Schneider says there aren't really any options for monitors on Bogosov because the island is so small.
It'd be difficult to actually put much of a monitoring network on it. And even if there were seismic instruments there, they likely would have been destroyed by eruptive activity at this point.
The decision on where the AVO places equipment, Schneider says, is based on how much threat a volcano poses to nearby people and property. And there's all sorts of different tools the organization can use to monitor volcanic activity, from seismic instruments to satellites to infrasound data. In the case of Bogosov, they're not in the business of predicting eruptions. Schneider has worked in Alaska for two decades and says Bogosov's eruption is unlike anything he's seen in the state.
We don't have any other experience with this type of eruption style with a vent through the ocean, during my time period in Alaska. The previous eruption of Bogosov was in 1992, and there were no nearby seismometers like we have now that would allow us to do this kind of analysis that we're currently conducting.
So the ongoing explosions and seismic activity at Bogosov are writing the history books for what eruptions at this volcano look like. But the distant monitoring instruments on Umnak Island and in Sandpoint are only picking up the largest seismic events. Chris Way Thomas is a geologist for USGS. While he's glad there's a network to support monitoring of Bogosov 24 years after its last eruption, he doesn't think it's enough.
I think we're still missing a fair bit of the story. I think there's a lot more going on out there than we're not catching. So that's a little frustrating.
One thing the team missed was the date of the first eruption back in December. AVO first noticed the eruption on December 20th after a pilot reported an ash plume. But looking back at the seismic record, they now believe activity began more than a week earlier. Way Thomas says watching the eruption progress is interesting, but he's more interested for what comes next.
What we're doing now is, the real-time volcano monitoring and preliminary interpretation of the data streams. A lot of the story remains to be told.
Way Thomas says hundreds of papers can be written after eruptions like this one. He's hoping once the volcano cools off and Bogosov Island is safe, he'll be able to check it out for himself. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
President Donald Trump has angered many Native activists by moving to restart construction on the Dakota Access Pipeline. Thousands have protested the line, saying it could poison the Standing Rock COX's water supply. They also see it as an affront to tribal sovereignty. But before Trump's inauguration, his transition team met with Native leaders to ask what they wanted out of the new administration. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfield has the story.
The meetings were billed as listening sessions with Trump's Native American coalition and included members of the president's transition team. The coalition, formed just before November's election, is chaired by Republican U.S. Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, a member of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Jacqueline Peta of the Juneau-based Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska was among those at the Western meeting. She's executive director of the National Council of American Indians and a board member of Sea Alaska, Southeast's regional Native corporation.
There are things in this administration's agenda that we can find common ground on, like infrastructure development, like improving the economies of our communities. But tribal leaders made it really clear tribes are governments and should be treated as such and respected as such.
She said tribal leaders brought up health care, government contracting, education, and resource extraction. That included opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Tribal leaders said things like, we're not opposed to development, but we want to be able to make sure that we have a meaningful place and that our consent is part of the process of evaluating the permits that may affect our lands.
Micklin said an overriding issue was the future of Obamacare.
We're concerned that the repeal, the Affordable Health Care Act, not also repeal the Indian Health Care Act and not reduce funding for it from our other funding sources.
Another issue brought up in the meetings was land into trust. That program allows tribal governments to transfer title to the federal government, which protects the land from taxation or seizure. Alaska Native tribes have just begun using the program. Mark Trahant is a former University of Alaska journalism professor and a blogger on Native issues. He's a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, now teaching at the University of North Dakota.
That was kind of evolving late in the Obama administration, and now organizations and tribes want to follow through. They're going to need some sort of mechanical side to make the process work, and whether or not resources are put into that by the administration, I think will be interesting to see.
Changes in the state's far north are also being watched by some Alaska Native leaders. Trahant worries the new administration doesn't know much about it beyond the potential for oil and gas production. That's especially since Trump and members of his administration question the human role in climate change.
Even thinking about the United States as an Arctic nation and what a changing Arctic nation, and what does that mean and what are the policy implications? The Obama administration had pushed very hard on the environmental side of that, but now you may see things like more interest in shipping lanes and resource extraction and that sort of Arctic issues.
Trahant predicts tribes will have fewer problems with Ryan Zinke, Trump's pick to lead the Interior Department. He says the Montana congressman understands tribal sovereignty and other key issues.
The person who's been nominated for Interior Secretary is an avid fisherman, and at least he understands the language of that and recognizes the importance of a healthy fishery, both as a food source and subsistence.
Trump takes over from an administration that expanded relations with tribal governments and other Native groups. Each department had a Native liaison who reached out and addressed concerns. Tlingit Haida Central Council's PETA is among those hoping that continues in some form, but they say Obama will be a hard act to follow.
What made a big difference was President Obama went to Indian country, and when he saw it, it compelled him. I'm hoping that we do get high-level officials from the Trump administration into Indian country and that they will feel the same desire to bring some of their drive for economic opportunity to Indian country as well.
While those attending the Trump team's Native coalition meetings were encouraged by the interest, they know many of their concerns don't mesh with the new administration's goals. That's certainly the case with the Dakota Pipeline. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
The Iditarod may once again be moving to Fairbanks. The decision hasn't been made yet, but low snow along difficult parts of the trail are prompting officials to consider moving the race's restart from Willow to Fairbanks for only the third time in the race's history. According to the Iditarod Trail Committee, much of South Central Alaska has good snow conditions, but the areas around Rainy Pass and Dalzell Gorge do not. That's the same section of trail where mushers saw dangerous conditions in 2014, conditions that led to injuries and widespread criticism over the routing through the Alaska Range. Officials say crews are monitoring the trail closely, and they'll make their final decision on the restart after February 10th. If they do pick Fairbanks over Willow, it'll be the second time in a row that the race has skipped the southern route, bypassing communities like Shagaluk, Anvik, and Grayling. The Fairbanks route extends west to Tanana, then down the Yukon toward Ruby, with a detour north to Husslia. The longest leg is 119 miles, a far greater distance than the biggest stretch in traditional routes. Currently, there are 75 teams signed up to run Iditarod 45. Even if the official location is moved, the ceremonial start will be in Anchorage on March 4th. And that's the news from Sandpoint. I'm Marissa Williams, and you're listening to KSDP 830 AM.